Intervju Radija Študent.
Dragi poslušalci in poslušalke, pozdravljeni v Eraš intervjuju. Danes je z nami Derek Holzer, ameriški zvočni umetnik in izdelovalec inštrumentov, ki deluje in ustvarja med Helsinki in Berlinom. Trenutno se nahajamo pred prostori umetniškega kolektiva Cirkulacija na kvadrat, kjer v teh dneh tudi gostuje in se bo danes predstavil z audiovizualnim performancem Vector Synthesis ob 21.
The thing that I wanted to ask you first, on your website, we can see you somehow entitled yourself as a sound artist and an instrument builder. How do you see yourself fit in this cultural scene, since you work also in DIY scene and also in institutional art world, and how do you feel about it and how do you go about it?
Much less in the institutional art world. I've always considered myself to be kind of a mongrel dog and just kind of doing whatever it takes to get by a little bit. The fact that I'm doing a little bit of academic stuff now is that I never did anything much with that before, so now I'm kind of catching up on something else, but mostly it's just been kind of by any means necessary.
Mm-hmm. And you also say in some videos that you didn't go like through formal training of like electronics and stuff like this. So what kind of background do you come from? How do you get into electronics and circuit bending and all this? Was it through music or more studying art or?
Well, when I teach or when I give talks, usually one of the first things that I do is I try to, undercut my own authority maybe. But the first thing that I tell people is that I failed every math class I was ever forced to take in my entire life. And if 17-year-old me knew that, well, some years later in life, me of the current moment would be traveling around the world programming computers and building analog electronics and working in the field that I do, 17-year-old me would have laughed, but maybe he would have studied algebra a little bit more too, I don't know. I never saw any purpose for it at that point, so I just kind of gave up on it. But kind of everything that I do, it comes a little bit from not knowing how to do something else. I got into sound in kind of a roundabout way. I've always been really interested in sound. I was really interested in experimental music already when I was in high school, and a lot of electronic industrial stuff. And when I say industrial, I don't mean like industrial dance music. I mean, that's kind of more the lineage of Throbbing Gristle and Einstürzende Neubauten and these kind of groups. So I was always interested in that kind of stuff. But I never had the discipline to learn a proper instrument. I had a keyboard and I had a guitar, and I never really spent enough time with them to feel comfortable with them at all. Maybe the revelation of people like Einstürzende Neubauten was that you can bang on a shopping cart and that's also a music instrument. So I didn't pursue this interest in sound so much until later. I got really involved in writing. Actually, for most of my 20s, I thought I was going to be a novelist or some sort of writer in some way or another. And it wasn't until later that I kind of fell back into sound a little bit. And I came back into it when I started to realize that what I was interested in was sound and not music. Music is a really small area of sound. It's an area that's like a fraction of a percent of what sound is in its totality. So I figured, well, I should just work in... I should concentrate not on musical sounds, but I should concentrate on trying to avoid musical sounds and on using any other kind of sound that I find. So like a lot of people, I bought a mini disc recorder, which was the kind of the current digital technology that you could use, and a cheap microphone, and I started making field recordings. And then from there, I started downloading plugins and hacked software and all the stuff that you use to process those things. And made my own education in sound through experimentation like that. What I realized really quickly was that whenever you're engaging with a piece of music technology, you're engaging with the mind of the person who created that technology. And what's more than that, you're accepting their way of thinking about how something should be made. So the easier that a piece of technology makes it for you to create any sort of creative work, whether it's graphic software or a Korg keyboard or whatever it is, the easier that tool makes it for you to create work, the more you're accepting somebody else's way of working and somebody else's idea of what an image or what sound or what something else is. You're working through the sets of possibilities that they've given you. So I got really frustrated with that. I got frustrated with the fact that I had a plug-in, and let's say it was an emulation of a guitar distortion, and there was a button and three knobs. And if it was a real guitar pedal, I could turn it around to the backside, I could unscrew it, I could stick my soldering iron in there, and I could make something else out of it. And if you download a piece of software, and if it's not free software, then it's completely locked. There's nothing else you can do to it to change the function of it, nor can you learn how it was put together and made in order to recreate it in a way that's more suitable to your own purposes. So I went from working with closed software and VST plugins to things like Pure Data, which is what I still use to this day when I'm working digitally, which is an environment where you can start to design your own tools. You can design your entire environment. And if you don't think in terms of tempos and beats per minute, or if you don't think in terms of Western musical scales and do, re, mi, and if you don't think in terms of quarter notes and half notes, you don't have to. I think about things in terms of milliseconds. I think about things in terms of hertz. And particularly now, I think about things in terms of harmonics, which kind of leads you around the backside to music theory somehow, but I'm thinking about them in mathematical ratios now. A lot of math, a lot of numbers, which is at the heart actually what music is.
And I guess also perceptibility of it. Like in one of your videos, you also talk about the refresh rate of the brain's processing visuals and sound and all this stuff.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. And it's one that I talk a lot about when we start building really basic synthesizers in my workshops. I get the participants to like connect a wire to a speaker and make a little click, and then I ask them how fast they can do that, and you know usually they can do it a couple of times a second, and then I ask them, well, how, like right now every time you touch the wire you hear a click. How many times would you have to touch the wire in 1 second before it stopped being clicks and it starts being a tone? How many is that?
Yeah, it's 30, 25, something about that, like image.
Yeah, how many frames in a second do I have to show you?
Same thing, yeah.
Yeah. And how many, if it's the same thing, I know I have friends that work with tactile motors and things like that, and it's the same thing if you put a motor on somebody's skin that's tapping them. If it's tapping only a few times a second, you perceive each tap, and as you get closer and closer to that magic number, then it starts to turn into a varying sensation of pressure rather than individual taps. And so it's very unscientifically, because I haven't tested any of this stuff so much, but it makes me think that that's what the threshold of now in the brain is. Mm-hmm. Is it's somewhere about, you know, 1/25th, 1/30th of a second. It's the latency of the eye. Is one thing, but your ears perceive very high frequencies. I mean, you can play the ear at 10,000 hertz and it hears that, but your brain takes it as one event rather than discrete events. So it has to do something with the processing time of the brain, how long the brain takes to realize something's going on. And if it happens faster than that, all the things that happen in that moment get lumped together as now.
Yeah.
In that one thing. So anyway, that's a little esoteric, I don't know.
No, I mean, I've seen that you're also interested in media archaeology and this media theoretician, Friedrich Hitler. He also talks about like the betraying of the senses, making senses obsolete and this kind of stuff. Mm. So I was, I don't know if I'm correct, but I read this thing that we'll be seeing tonight, the vector synthesis, also in that manner, like testing the thresholds of the eye, how fast can it track the image, It's a sort, if I understand it right, it's a sort of shift from this frame to frame animation and all this.
Yeah, let's go backwards for a second and talk about what the project I'll be showing tonight is. It's something that's called vector synthesis. And I should emphasize that I'm a sound artist. I've been working in sound for well, for as long as I've been working in it, you know, almost 20 years now. And so I come from everything with a perception of how frequencies and sound signals work. But I've been very interested in this relationship between image and sound also for an extremely long time. And where I've gotten to that is, earlier I did a lot of projects where I was using, I was translating light pulses into sound. So I would use different kind of spinning discs to chop up a beam of light, and that light would fall on a photo transistor that would allow current to flow. If you connect that current to a speaker, it moves the speaker and you hear that as sound. That's the technology that's in a optical film projector, like you would see a 16 millimeter or 35 millimeter film projector has this optical soundtrack along the side of the film there, and that's what that is. It's just modulated light converted into electricity. And I did a lot of projects building synthesizers using modulated light to create sounds. And I thought, well, now I should try working the other way around. Now I should use sound to create light. And so that's what this project is. The main part of the vector synthesis project is that I use something called a vector monitor, and I send three different audio signals into it. A vector monitor is different from a normal video monitor, because in a normal video monitor you have lines and pixels, and there's a certain number of pixels in a line and a certain number of lines in a frame, and everything gets chopped into these little sampled discrete pieces of information. So you always have this problem of resolution. You can't draw a straight line or a curved line. You have to draw blocks of pixels shifted around and kind of disguised to make you think that there's a curve there. With the vector synthesis, there's simply a beam of light, and that beam of light moves up and down, and it moves left and right, and I can turn up or down the intensity of that beam. And because of that, if I send an audio signal into there, it's not a digital blocky representation of a curve or a line or something like that. It is a real line that's arcing through real space. And I can't say that the resolution of that is infinite, but it's way better than what I can get trying to render something on a screen. But also, it's more direct for me. If you listen to a video signal, you get this very choppy, square wavy sort of thing. But if you listen to the signals that I'm sending to this vector monitor, you hear and see the exact same thing. And that's also very interesting to me, is that there's this connection between these two things. The vector monitors, you can send fairly high frequency signals into them, and what happens is you get these spinning kind of moiré patterns that do very bizarre things to your eye. And these are things that if I try to film that or put a digital camera on that and project that onto a digital screen, it gets flattened and eliminated and sampled back into pixels by this digital equipment. So actually the best way to experience this stuff is to sit down with your face in front of the monitor and see it in its actual condition. Everything else after that is kind of a poor sampling of it. It's a poor re-presentation of it. So what I've been working with here at Circulacia is to work with a laser so that I can directly use a beam of light projected on the wall and move that with audio signals. That has its own set of problems because you can't move that beam very fast because it's moved by motors, and these motors have a limit of the speed that they can move at. So whatever I do with this laser is going to be much less high frequency, and there'll be a lot less chance of these kind of optical illusion effects. But I can certainly render some very interesting shapes and move them around. And the laser is a very new thing for me. I'm experimenting with it in depth for the first time here at Circulacia. So what you'll see tonight is very much a work in progress, and let's say an investigation, an artistic investigation into the possibilities of mapping this one kind of media onto another kind of a media. What makes vector synthesis a piece of media archaeology is that these vector monitors are based on a cathode ray tube, a CRT, and these are rapidly becoming obsolete. Nobody uses them anymore because they're big, they're heavy, they suck up a lot of power. So what happens is this whole history of the broadcast image on televisions is now be kind of thrown away. They're all getting put on boats and being sent back to China where they were made in the first place to rot in a hole in the ground somewhere, and that's kind of the end of their trajectory. So by using these pieces of obsolete technology and trying to find something that's very specific to that medium, that can't be done in any other medium, I think is very interesting. It's a way of kind of claiming them back and saying, this stuff is just, it's going to be garbage anyway. Let's explore some possibilities. And I think this is a big motivation in the hacker scene and the demo scene, is to find ways of reusing and exploiting obsolete stuff that is, it's destined to be garbage. But there's another level of it, which I think is very interesting, and it's stuff that you can kind of pick up from Kittler and reading Siegfried Zielinski, and even going back as far as McLuhan, is that we keep inventing new pieces of technology to make our lives better and to solve essentially the same problems over and over again. And when we realize that one piece of technology doesn't solve that problem, then we invent another one and they sell you some other things. So the CRT didn't help us become better people. So now we have to make these flat screens. McLuhan talks about this idea that that we extend our senses through technology, and that in a time, for example, where we feel our sense of visuality is under assault or threatened or wounded in some way, we try to extend that sense of vision through artificial means. And so that's what film and television and video and now things like virtual reality and all whatever the next new things that the next kids on the block invent are all trying to help us get over this wound, in this eyeball wound that we're suffering somehow. But none of them do it.
Yeah.
So we just keep inventing new shit all over again. And I don't know, can I say shit on the Slovene radio?
Yeah.
So we keep inventing new stuff to solve the same problem all over again. And that's a fundamental question I want to ask, is why? Why is it necessary that we need new stuff? The opposite argument is this accelerationist argument, that actually we should put faith in technology and we should develop things as fast as possible, because the quicker we invent new stuff, the faster we're going to solve all of our problems. And this is a critique to that. It's saying, no, actually, we keep inventing new stuff to solve the same problems over and over and over again. We haven't actually advanced in the 20th century at all. We've gone from, magic lanterns to virtual reality, and we're still not satisfied. It still hasn't fixed that problem.
Yeah.
So why do we keep doing this? So it's a very willful act to say, okay, my definition of visual technology is from a particular era now. Let's say it's from 1950 to 1970, and everything that I'm going to investigate happened in that moment. Why? What kind of experiments did we do in that time? What kind of technology did we have then? Actually, sometimes going back and reproducing technology from the 1950s is harder than going to the Saturn or whatever, the media market and just buying something on a USB stick or something like that. You know, it's archaeology isn't easy work. The metaphor I keep using with the people here in Sokolasi is like this idea of they call it like living archaeology or something, you know, where guys go and they decide that they're studying a certain time period of human history, so they've got to put a bear skin on and go live in a cave and cook with a fire so they understand how people during that time
performative
did that
kind of thing.
Yeah, it's not just a performative thing, it's like a living experience. It's
yeah.
Like obviously we can't understand I think it's impossible for us to understand the mindset of a Neolithic human being, but at least to give it a try and see, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You have to understand that your subject position is very tainted as well, and you bring your subject position into anything that you think you're investigating objectively, and I'm very aware of that, so.
Yeah, it's such a pity that we've pretty much ran out of time. Thanks for elaborating all these details about your practice, and looking forward to seeing you tonight.
Thanks. Thank you for letting me rant and rave on the radio, and thank you for the hospitality, Ljubljana.
Tole je bil RS intervju z Derekom Holcerjem, ki bo danes ob 21. nastopil v prostorih Cirkulacije na kvadrat. Intervju sem pripravil Staš.
Intervju Radija Študent.